I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Tsunami Tuesday is living up to the hype. Record numbers of voters are turning out across the country, even though winter storms are hitting 10 of the 24 states taking part in Tuesday's presidential primaries. Democratic rivals Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama both agree their contest won't be decided today, but a Republican could emerge. John McCain and Mitt Romney are fighting for that top spot, followed by Mike Huckabee and Ron Paul. We're going to touch down across the country. With us, Lois Romano, national political reporter for The Washington Post, currently a fellow at Harvard University's Institute of Politics at the John F. Kennedy School of Government. Lois, welcome.
Thanks for coming in, Robin.
Now, generally speaking, let's remind ourselves, delegates are generally more important for Democrats and states generally more important for Republicans?
That's right. The delegate count is very interesting because what you have to watch tonight is not just who wins the states, because everybody's going to be claiming victory of states, but you have to watch how many delegates they get. So Hillary Clinton could win California, but Barack Obama could get almost as many delegates because they split the delegates.
Right. And let's start with the state that has the biggest number of delegates. It's considered the biggest prize. 370 Democratic delegates, 179 Republican in California. Now, the California Republican system, it's, as we're going to see, the systems vary across the country. California is very funky. It awards three delegates per congressional district on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, it's proportioned, as you said, but on the Republican side, it's proportioned by three delegates per congressional district. Carla Marinucci is political reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. She joins us now. And Carla, analyst Dan Schnur says the system for Republicans in California means a candidate could get 100,000 votes in a populated area and get three delegates, or take three Republicans out to dinner in Berkeley and get three delegates.
That's absolutely right, Robin. This is a system, I think, that favors John McCain, particularly in those moderate districts, Berkeley, San Francisco. Those could be pickups for him. He could get as many delegates out of those districts as, say, Mitt Romney does by campaigning day and night in some of the conservative districts in Southern California where there's tens of thousands of Republicans.
Right. You could get many more votes, but if you don't get the delegates, that's what counts. What about on the Democratic side? Independents in California can vote for a Democrat, although they can't cross over and vote for a Republican. That does help Barack Obama, doesn't it?
Absolutely. One in five voters are independent in California. In some districts like San Francisco, a third of the voters are independent. We're expecting record turnout in California, 9 million voters going to the polls today.
And what are the issues that are drawing them?
Certainly the economy, major issue. We've got the highest gas prices in the country. And since we're a driving state, that is a issue that hits home with lots of people. Technology is an issue. The war in Iraq is a very big issue still. Both in the military district, San Diego, and in districts like San Francisco, where that has driven a lot of the support for Barack Obama.
And again, on the Democratic side, that race has really tightened between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton.
Clinton had a 25-point lead at one time. It is now down to a dead heat. So this has been a wild race all the way down to the finish in California.
Carla Marinucci, political reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Everybody's going to be staying up late to see what California does.
Well, it looks like these voting machines here are so screwed up. With 20 counties being forced to use paper ballots, including some very large counties like San Diego and Sacramento, it could be days before we actually find out. They're actually going to have to count these ballots by hand.
And given that, you know, there's two very close races now, the Romney-McCain race is timed up.
Yeah, you know, they're going to have 2 million paper ballots coming in. The vote by mails are expected to be come back in today, too. I mean, so all that means no results right away.
Huh. Carla, thank you.
Okay, welcome.
Okay, Lois Romano, your thoughts on that? I mean, here's a tight race and one of the rare states where it's not a winner-take-all for Republicans. Your thoughts on it? There may be this huge delay.
Well, there might be, but I also think that there'll be some predictive elements to it because it's not all paper, and they'll see what some trends are, and they'll be able to kind of get a sense of what's going on in the state. I mean, I do think it's going to be, for somebody to say, I'm the winner, probably will take a few days, but I think they might be able to have a sense of what their delegates counts are.
Okay. Well, let's turn now to Massachusetts, traditionally a very blue state, but also one of Mitt Romney's home states. He's the former governor, of course. It's an open primary here for both parties. That means independents can cross over to either party and vote. Joining us, Fred Tice, political reporter for WBUR, our home station. And Fred, voters, you say, are telling you they don't know what they're going to do.
That's right. Most of the voters here, or I should say the largest block of voters here, are independent voters. So they can choose to vote in the Democratic or Republican primaries. And I spoke to several voters this morning who really, you know, had to think, were they going to go in the Republican primary and vote for John McCain, or the Democratic primary and vote for Obama? And I found people who made opposing decisions.
Voters also who are Democrats torn between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. But staying with the drift to the Republican side, are you hearing what we heard in New Hampshire? Independents who are Democratic-leaning crossing over to vote for John McCain as a vote against Mitt Romney.
I did meet one voter who did that this morning, but I also met some voters who were saying, you know, they'd consider doing that, but they just thought it was more important to go into the Democratic race because that race is so close there.
And we should say Republican former Governor Mitt Romney has huge support from talk radio in town. Is this expected to be a tight race with McCain?
No, it's not expected to be a tight race at all. The Romney campaign is very encouraged by the fact that the polls show him so far ahead of John McCain.
Right. But on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton had been running very strong here, but then Senator Ted Kennedy endorsed Barack Obama. How much has that changed the landscape?
Well, in the last 2 weeks, we've had a complete change in the polls here. Massachusetts was the state where Hillary Clinton had the biggest lead in the polls, even more than her home state of New York.
37 points.
Yeah. And the last poll conducted yesterday found that Barack Obama has slipped ahead of her in Massachusetts. And so we don't really know whether that's part of a national tide or whether that has more to do with the local conditions here, which is that Senator Edward Kennedy, Governor Deval Patrick, and Senator John Kerry all have endorsed Barack Obama.
While the mayor of Boston stays with Clinton. Fred Tice, political reporter for WBUR. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Robin.
Okay, Lois Ramona, let's take a second here. We've now touched down in two big states, two of the biggest prizes. Your sense of this race that's so tight and also, you know, has factors like independence in it.
I think basically what we're seeing here is a classic fight between the future and inspiration and experience. And, you know, what's very interesting to me is that Obama seems to be on a trajectory. And they're even saying if they had more time, and I think that's right. I think if they had a couple of more days, they might do a sweep. But, I mean, just to add to your reporter, I think it's a combination of the local environment and Kennedy and Duvall endorsing him. But I also think he's on an upward swing right now.
And he has said, gee, if the trajectory had continued, as you said, a couple more days. But, you know, on the Republican side, Mitt Romney's saying the same thing. He's saying, I'm chipping away. His backers are furious that Mike Huckabee is staying in the race. They feel Mike Huckabee siphoning votes from Mitt Romney. Is he right that if he had a few more days and maybe someone dropping out, he might be giving more of a battle?
You know, it's hard to know. I'm not seeing that. I mean, I think Huckabee is taking some of the evangelicals. And I think efforts to try to couch something as a two-man race don't really work. We saw John Edwards do that. So I think in the end, voters have kind of an interesting instinct, and they know where they're going, and that they're not going to waste their vote. They're going to vote for where they want it to go. And I'm just not sure it's with Romney right now.
Well, let's take a look where that race is perhaps in play. Southwest, John McCain's home state of Arizona. John McCain famously said to Mitt Romney in one of the last debates, my state's going to endorse me and vote for me. A dig because the Boston Globe did not endorse former Governor Mitt Romney. Let's turn to Matt Benson, political reporter for the Arizona Republic. Matt, is John McCain's claim still true, or do you see some backlash there in Arizona against McCain's push for immigration reform?
Well, there may be some backlash on immigration reform, especially among very conservative members of the party, but he has been polling somewhere between 10 and 15, 10 and 20 points in the lead. So he's certainly expected to win here handily.
Yeah, and how about on the Democratic side? Hillary Clinton had been leading a strong support base in Arizona among Latino voters. Can Barack Obama chip into that? Because they've been certainly working that state, haven't they?
Well, both candidates have been here post the South Carolina primary. Both candidates have been here as well as their surrogates. The question is whether Obama has time to overtake Senator Clinton here. Most recent polls show her up somewhere around 5 points.
Has he been gaining on her? Is that what you're saying? Or
absolutely. She had been up somewhere 15, 20 points as recently as 3 weeks, a month ago. But like I say, he's chipped into that considerably since.
Matt Benson, political reporter with the Arizona Republic. Matt, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So, Lois Romano, there again, another tight race where there's an arc, Barack Obama chipping away at Hillary Clinton. And it brings into play the Hispanic Latino vote in the Southwest. How do you think that's going to play out?
You know, I don't think we know yet. The conventional wisdom is that Obama won't do well with Latinos. And I don't think that's really clear just yet. He did, campaign with, or he had his wife campaign with Oprah and Caroline, and he's trying to get some of that women's vote away from Hillary to kind of compensate for the Latinos. But I think it's too early to know. I mean, the only kind of clear thing we have right now is that Hillary looks like she's comfortably ahead in New York and Obama's way ahead in Illinois. And I think all the other races can go either way at this point.
Well, we're going to check in New York in just a minute, but first we're going to stay in another region, turning to Georgia. Georgia, by the way, one of three states that requires voters to present photo identification. Reporter Charles Edwards is covering that election for Atlanta Public Broadcasting. Charles, as Lois was saying, in much of the country, the Republican race is between Mitt Romney and John McCain. But where you are, Mike Huckabee is still a contender.
He definitely still is a contender. If you look at Mike Huckabee, he's a Southern governor from Arkansas, and he is a Baptist minister, so that plays very well in Georgia. Georgia is a Republican state that President Bush carried in two consecutive presidential elections. So Huckabee definitely still has a shot. But since New Hampshire and a lot of the polls that have been done with voters on the Republican side, McCain has really gained an edge. Someone who was sort of seen as not really a player in Georgia early on in the primary contest has definitely taken a lead here in Georgia.
Oh, briefly, on the Democratic side, do you agree with the pundits who say that South Carolina is a bellwether for states like Georgia, meaning Barack Obama will do well?
It really is. Barack Obama did extremely well. Georgia has a 30% African-American population. South Carolina has at least 30%. It's somewhere also close to 50. However, a lot of polls are showing that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are really neck and neck, that it's really a close race.
And very, very briefly, any thought there of where the John Edwards votes are going?
Well, I talked to one Edwards supporter this week who said that the reason why she was supporting Edwards was because poverty, she felt, was a major, major issue, and an issue that a lot of candidates never really focused on the way that Edwards did. And she decided to vote for Obama after Edwards dropped out.
Charles Edwards, political reporter for Atlanta Public Broadcasting. Charles, thanks.
Thank you.
And Lois Romano, back in the studio, we have just a few seconds before we take a break. But, Barack Obama is reported to be getting most of the African-American vote in every primary. You're nodding yes. Is he going to be getting the John Edwards, the people who cared about the worker vote?
Anecdotally, it certainly looks that way. I mean, if you go back and listen to the last few debates, Edwards did everything but tell his supporters telepathically to go to Obama. He is saying he's staying neutral, but I think a lot of those people will go with Obama.
Okay, that's Lois Romano, national political reporter for The Washington Post, but happily currently a fellow at Harvard University's Institute of Politics at the John F. Kennedy School of Government. So she's with us today. Hold on to your hats. Our trip around the country continues. We want to go to New York, Missouri, and see how record turnouts, huge turnouts today, how the primaries are going across the country. A lot at stake. You're listening to Here and Now, back in 1 minute. It's Super Tuesday, and joining us in the studio, Lois Romano, national political reporter for The Washington Post and a fellow this year at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. And Lois, before we continue our trip around the country, just a thought for you. The candidates today are saying, on the morning shows, they feel that this huge turnout that we're already seeing and record numbers we're expecting by the end of the day is good for them, no matter who wins, because it means that more people get in the political process. And Hillary Clinton, for instance, saying that means more people that, perhaps they might be disappointed. She's saying that their guy didn't win, but we can bring them over to our side. Is that true?
Yes. I think in this particular election, the more turnout, the better for everyone. Historically, higher turnout meant that it was a negative vote. It was against somebody. They were coming out because they were passionate that way. I think in this election, you're seeing a lot of passion among women for Hillary. You're seeing a lot of passion among African Americans for Barack Obama. You're seeing a lot of passion on the Republican side trying to figure out where the country should go after a disappointing few years with George Bush. So, yes, I think high turnout is fabulous for everyone.
Okay, well, let's take a look at what's happening in Missouri. Joe Amanis is political correspondent for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. It's been a big year for Missouri. Joe, why have so many candidates been there?
Missouri has long been a bellwether state. We often reflect the national mood. We have the best record of going with the winner. Whoever carries Missouri has gone to the White House and all but once in the last 100 years. And this year, all the major candidates from both parties have been in the state within the last couple of days. In the last 2 weeks, it's tightened up, so it's really too close to call for both the Republican and Democrats, so no one knows who's going to win today.
Well, let's ask some questions, though. Mayor Rudy Giuliani was leading in Missouri. He's now out of the race. Who's taken his supporters?
McCain.
And how about the Edwards voters?
Well, the Edwards voters, it appears, split.
Well, your governor is a Romney guy, but what are the issues that are driving voters there on the Republican side?
Well, on the Republican side, although we have a small Hispanic population, immigration has been a big issue. The economy is big for everyone on both sides, and also taxes. We have a large Republican religious conservative base here in Missouri, so abortion, gay marriage, embryonic stem cell research, those are also very important
right.
issues.
We've reported on embryonic stem cell research in the state, and McCain is for it, Romney was for, now against. Huckabee is against, so that's a big draw. I just want to ask you one last question. We know in Missouri you can pick a ballot for any party regardless of the party you're affiliated with, but that can be challenged if someone at the poll sees that you are actually from one party voting for another, maybe to derail another candidate?
Yes, by law they can do that, but in practice it's never done.
Joe Manis, political correspondent for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Joe, thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much for asking me.
And back in the studio, Lois Romano. People are saying that this may be the year. There might be a challenge because there are people who are voting, as you said, maybe not in huge numbers, but there are people who are voting against candidates. We saw it in New Hampshire in that primary, too. Your thoughts on that?
I think that we're seeing it a little bit less. But, yes, I think there is I think there's an anti I saw an anti-Romney kind of movement and a little bit with Giuliani among conservatives, actually, on Giuliani's part because he had a record of being liberal on social issues, and on Romney's part because people didn't think he was actually sincere about going to the right on social issues. I'm not seeing it as much on the Democratic side. I think the people that you're seeing coming out are very for Hillary, for Obama. They were for Edwards.
Well, I want to ask you just quickly about what you've said, though. There's sort of the battle within the GOP. We talked about it yesterday, the right-wing radio attacks on McCain, the claim by fervent Romney supporters, and they think they have a valid claim that he is not a conservative. We just heard he is for stem cell research. We heard that in Missouri. But on the other hand, against abortion, for a long-term effort in Iraq. Is he being set up as a liberal by the Republicans when, in fact, and maybe voted for by independents when, in fact, he's not?
I think that's what, of course, they're trying to do, but they haven't been very successful. I mean, Rush Limbaugh spends all his capital and 25 million listeners trying to discredit him. Romney's gone after him. He's got a conservative record. So I don't think it's been successful, but yes, that's what they've been doing.
Well, we want to take a quick look in New York, the second largest number of delegates after California. Phil Fairbanks reported with the Buffalo News. Phil, first of all, we should say New York isn't Manhattan. There's a huge upstate area, Buffalo right in it. And how do voters there think differently than, say, people in Times Square?
Yeah, very differently, actually, Robin. You know, here the economy is a huge, huge issue. Upstate New York, not just Buffalo, but all of upstate New York, mm-hmm. has really missed out on a lot of the prosperity that the country experienced in the 1990s. So the economy is probably a bigger issue here than it is downstate.
Well, Hillary Clinton was said to have won as senator because she went upstate and convinced people up there that she would stand for them. How is she faring going into this primary with upstaters?
She's expected to win. The latest poll indicated she had at least 53% of the vote. Some people think she'll get 60%. But the question is, how many delegates will she get? That's really where the fight is in New York among the Democrats.
Has Barack Obama cut into that? I mean, has he risen there?
He definitely has. After his victory in South Carolina, the number of volunteers that are part of his campaign has increased dramatically. Some people think he may get 30 to 40% of the delegates. Unlike the Republicans here, the Democratic primary is not winner-take-all.
Right. On the Republican side, New York lost its Republican favorite, Rudy Giuliani. Who's picking up those votes?
Almost entirely in terms of the Republican establishment statewide, from Buffalo to New York, almost all of them have gone over to McCain. So mm-hmm. McCain is expected to win pretty easily and get all 101 delegates. Romney and Huckabee, to a large extent, I think, have conceded New York to McCain.
Phil Fairbanks, political reporter for the Buffalo News. Phil, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that completes our tour around the country. Lois Romano, your thoughts here. We're hearing about people having a passion. You speak about today being about a passion about a candidate. Is it, after today, do you think, going to shift back, as it seems to have in New York, to hard issues, the economy?
I don't know if it's going to do it after today. It might do it in a month when the field starts narrowing down. But, I mean, it has to go that way. Right now, if you look at, particularly on the Democratic side, we're talking about nuances in their policy differences. And so people are really voting character and personality right now.
Lois Romano, national political reporter for The Washington Post and right now a Kennedy fellow at Harvard. Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Hope to have you back. And, of course, if we missed your state again, we're sorry. And tomorrow we'll give you the full count, as much as we can, with California maybe having problems. Still ahead today, why do some people in Brattleboro, Vermont want to arrest the president if he comes to town? That's coming up after the news here and now. French President Nicolas Sarkozy now says France is ready to launch a military operation against rebels in Chad, a former French colony. It's a reversal of earlier statements that France did not want to choose sides in the four-day-old conflict for fear of jeopardizing France's role in a European Union peacekeeping effort in Chad. Hundreds of thousands are fleeing the Chadian capital, where rebel forces have been trying to oust the president. The fighting has threatened to further destabilize an already violent swath of Africa, and it also puts into question efforts to aid the thousands of refugees who've crossed the border from Sudan's Darfur region into Chad. Christian Science reporter Scott Baldoff joins us from Johannesburg, South Africa. Scott, France has intervened before to protect Chad's government. It hesitated this time. Your thoughts on the statements that France might now intervene?
Well, I think this reflects the importance that not just France, but that the international community puts on Chad's role looking after all of these refugees. You count in the Chadian citizens who are taking shelter, who have been pushed out of their homes by fighting. You have 400,000 total. That includes 250,000 from Darfur. It is necessary for the international community to be able to provide humanitarian assistance to these refugees, and there needed to be law and order in the country. Now, unfortunately, France had been planning on leading an operation, a military operation, with other European countries. And France, because of its reputation of doing things its own way in its former colonies, intervening unilaterally, there are many European countries that are now going to worry, is this European mission going to be an arm of French foreign policy as usual? That undermines their credibility. It undermines potentially the neutrality of this mission in the eyes of other Chadians. And while it may not be intended to do so, it could be seen as taking sides in a political battle.
Which is the thing that France didn't want. I mean, this puts France in a very difficult position because it was hoping to prove to the other European countries that it was able to take part in the peacekeeping mission without some sort of former colonial goal of intervening in Chad, and now it may have to intervene in Chad in order to help the peacekeeping mission.
Precisely. Now, what helps France in this regard is to have the United Nations basically ask France to do this, give them the right to intervene. Up until now, France has, and particularly President Sarkozy, has been telling the world, we're a different France under me. We're going to cut our ties with a number of dictatorships. We're going to play fair. We're going to be more even-handed. We're going to support democracy, but not necessarily the regimes that have been our friends in the past. This particular intervention will test what those words really mean and will be the first test of that policy. And it appears in some ways that Sarkozy is having to pull back from that and support, unfortunately, a man who sought power 18 years ago by a military coup. And by the way, he did it exactly the same way these rebels did it. He started from Darfur.
That's the current president. He, as you said, assumed his role in a coup, but he was backed by the French government in other coup attempts against him. Now we have these rebels who are seem to be holding back around the edges of the capital, allowing the residents to flee, but still determined to take down this current president. Who are these rebels?
These rebels are primarily from President Deby's own tribe, the Zagawas, who live on both sides of the border, inside Chad and also inside Sudan in the Darfur region. They are people from his own government. There are military commanders who have recently defected. They claim that the reason why they're going after President Idriss Deby is because of the corruption, the ineptitude of his government, his increasing authoritarian style. But truth is, it may be that he just did not let them get what they wanted in power. It's unclear what they would do differently from President Deby if they were to come to power.
It's an oil-rich country. There's been charges of corruption. But as you said, maybe the corruption just didn't go in the way some rebels might have wanted it to go. Others are saying that these rebels are fighting a proxy war on behalf of Sudan. Is that true?
Well, there have been reports that Sudan backs these rebels. This is something that Sudan vigorously denies. What is certain is that these rebels take refuge inside Sudanese soil and at least tacitly enjoy the hospitality of Sudan. But whether or not they receive support is something that has yet to be proven with photographs, with checkbook receipts, and so on. Clearly, they are receiving arms, but the question of where the arms come from or where the funding for that comes from, I think, has not been directly established.
Scott, we just need to know if there's a recent news story has anything to do with this. We remember when the group Zoe's Ark members were charged with stealing children from Chad that the aid workers claimed were Sudanese orphans from Darfur. They turned out to be children from Chad with parents. This is a French rescue group. They were sent back to France where they're serving prison time, charged with kidnapping. Does that story factor into this conflict that we're seeing at all?
Only in the sense that there are so many people displaced living inside Chad and potentially so many aid workers looking for ways to help them. The story of Darfur obviously has brought Americans into the realm of African news. We pay attention to it a lot more as a result of the Darfur conflict. And that's true in France as well. This group appears to have been perhaps misled by their own staff on the ground as to the identity and the nationality of the children that they were trying to rescue. I would venture to guess that this is unrelated. It certainly does tie France, once again, quite closely to Chad. It shows that they are finding it very difficult to disentangle themselves from this former colony.
And finally, what effect is all of this violence and a possible coup and a possible military intervention from France? What impact is that having on the Darfur crisis?
At this stage, it complicates things greatly. There were reports that one of the Darfur rebel groups, the Justice and Equality Movement, was going to intervene on behalf of the government of President Deby. They were rushing to the capital to fight against the Chadian rebels. So you have now more than just the French, more than just the government, more than the rebels. You now are starting to get a very tangled, almost Lebanon-style fight with numerous groups, all with their own little agendas. It also obviously slows down the humanitarian operations. Almost all humanitarian groups, including the United Nations, evacuated their own personnel. That means that most of the work done in the camp servicing those 400,000 refugees has not ground to a halt, but certainly they have less capacity to meet new needs. There's food, but if there's no one to protect that food for those refugees, it stands the possibility of being looted by criminal gangs all around. So obviously, this has a huge impact on Darfur and on the refugees that are coming from there into what we thought was the safety of Chad.
And now two refugee populations, those from Darfur and those fleeing the capital of Chad, the Chadians.
That's correct.
Scott Baldoff, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us from Johannesburg, South Africa, about the crisis in Chad. Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In a quick note, later this week, we're going to speak with Ségolène Royal. She's the politician who ran against Nicolas Sarkozy and lost. We'll hear her thoughts on Chad and on another woman running for a top office. Also later this week, have you ever made a mixtape for someone? Well, a rock critic says, if you have, you've made some love. That's later this week. You're listening to Here and Now. The crunchy granola town of Brattleboro, Vermont, where you may recall public nudity was only banned after a man showed up buck naked from Arizona. Well, Brattleboro is in the headlines again. This time, a Brattleboro resident has succeeded in getting a petition before town voters next month to arrest President Bush and Vice President Cheney for crimes against the Constitution. It was signed by more than 436 residents, or 5% of Brattleboro voters, so the town select board approved the petition last month for a townwide vote on March 4th, and the calls and emails, some of them threatening, have not stopped since. So many that town leaders even stopped answering the phone for a while. Well, we've managed to reach Brattleboro area Chamber of Commerce Executive Director Jerry Goldberg. Jerry, how many emails and calls did you receive last week, and what kinds of things are they saying?
Out of the 1,864, we had over 1,000 positive, which is about 55%, and about 850 negative, at 45%. So while the negative ones were the first out of the gate, as people read in the press or heard on the radio reports about the beating that Brattleboro was taking, the positive thinkers decided to come to our defense and called us and said, hey, guys, you guys are doing exactly the right thing.
Well, now let's talk a little bit about that. First of all, you know, some of the negative emails are, you know, very threatening. Brent Kaflish of Minnesota wrote one saying that the three select board members who voted in favor of this petition going before the voters should have their heads cut off by terrorists who videotape it and put it on the internet. Kind of scary stuff.
Yeah.
Over what? Because does this vote have any weight to it? In other words, if Brattleboro voters do pass this petition, do you have any authority to arrest the president or the vice president?
No, absolutely not. I think the spirit of the petition was really more one of a symbolic statement. If Vice President Cheney and President Bush come to Brattleboro.
Oh, by the way, we should say that that's a part of it. They have to be in Brattleboro.
They have to be in Brattleboro. Well, in the 7 years plus of the administration, I'm not sure about Vice President Cheney, but I know President Bush hasn't set foot in the state of Vermont.
I think it's the only state he has not visited.
It's the only state he has not visited. We do not anticipate, even prior to this, that the president has any plans to come to Vermont anyway. So this is really a symbolic statement, I think, at best.
Well, and then why do it if it's just symbolism? Because it's had an impact on tourism. Of the negative emails that you've gotten, many people have said, well, I'll read one here, vacation to Vermont canceled.
Yes. Again, most of the negative people that the chamber heard from, now again, the town has gotten far, far, far more communications directed to it than the chamber has. The chamber, of course, because people, when they think, how can I get in touch with somebody there? Oh, I'll call the chamber. And most of the people, the negatives, were really saying, if you think I'm going to come to your town or your state, by the way, you bunch of nuts up there and all of that sort of thing. It's almost as though they've been harboring resentment about Vermont and then peripherally, if they've ever heard of Brattleboro, I think for a long, long time. And this was just another sort of opportunity for them to pick up the phone or dash out an email and sort of vent about their feelings about our state. Wherefore the rancor, bro? I don't know, but this is exactly what seems to be the case. They've been threatening. It's as if the entire country has always come here and we're canceling our plans. Would that all those people who are threatening never to come here again had ever come here to begin with, I think we'd be a very prosperous little burg here. My phone calls, I had 80 directly to myself. Positive 62%. Not that they necessarily agreed with the petition, but that they agreed with the spirit of this country that fosters and allows freedom of expression. And that's what this is all about. And they said, you sound like a pretty neat town, and when we're considering where to go and where to visit, you know, you're on our list now.
Yeah. Well, freedom of expression, and yet we do want to, again, underscore that Brattleboro drew the line at that guy from Arizona who arrived naked except for that strategically placed fanny pack.
That is absolutely true. And that was a hard one, I'll tell you. That one went on for months. It wasn't easy.
It was a fight over whether or not he should be banned.
Well, exactly. And what does nudity actually mean? I mean, it really got down. You had to go sit in some of those meetings. It was really quite educational.
Jerry Goldberg, Executive Director of the Brattleboro Area Chamber of Commerce, who knew the issues they had to deal with. Jerry, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, it's been my pleasure, Robin. Thanks for calling.
Coming up, get ready to move or be moved, a new collection of historic gospel recordings. That's in 1 minute, here and now. The rich history being celebrated this month, Black History Month, includes the history of gospel.
The cross in you, the cross in you, Jesus gonna make you dying be.
That's a 1954 recording of Alabama sharecropper Horace Sprott singing Jesus Gonna Make Up My Dying Bed. It's part of a new collection of over six decades of music, including selections by Lead Belly, the Reverend Gary Davis, and civil rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer. The CD is called Classic African American Gospel. It's being released by Smithsonian Folkways Recordings. And joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. is Kip Lornell. He compiled the collection. He wrote the liner notes. So, Kip, welcome.
Good afternoon.
And in doing so, in those liner notes, you take us through a chronology, starting with the Great Awakening of the 1730s, which brought more song to American religion, the Second Awakening, the Revival Movement, spirituals. Let's start right there. Spirituals. There's this, you know, we have a romantic maybe notion that these tunes had roots in Africa and then were, you know, developed in cotton fields. Do we know that for a fact?
Well, the whole history of spirituals is both a biracial and a complicated one, but the easiest way to think of it as music that developed in churches and in homes, probably 1830s, 1840s, the black and white tradition of spirituals was pretty well developed.
Are these songs from whites originally, blacks originally, or some mix originally?
The quick answer to that is yes. It is definitely a mix of black and white traditions, because if you think about spirituals, you do have to think about both black and white contributions to both the words that are being sung, but also the music as well.
Right. Well, we have some of the music. Let's listen. This is When I Was Sinking Down. It's sung by the Fisk Jubilee Singers. It was recorded in 1954, but you tell us that the group was founded in 1871, and this is, you know, some of the ways that spirituals and gospel music were used for other means, maybe besides the spiritual aspect. This was to promote the Fisk Free Colored School.
Yes, what is now Fisk University was one of the founding historically black colleges and universities in this country, and they were really struggling financially. It was just the end of the Civil War. There wasn't much money around, and one of the folks, Mr. White, got the bright idea to actually send out a group of musical ambassadors, first to nearby Ohio, then throughout the Midwest, with the idea of raising money to keep Fisk afloat.
Other uses of gospel included advocacy. You have a recording of civil rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer singing Go Tell It on the Mountain. Let's listen.
Go tell it on the mountain.
This particular selection was recorded in 1963 at a civil rights rally, and the idea was to have songs that people knew. Music so often actually brings people together, and there's nothing better than bringing people together at a biracial civil rights rally than to sing a spiritual that everybody knew.
And Fannie Lou Hamer, of course, famously attempted to register to vote in 1962. She lost her job. She was beaten, but still continued to risk her life. Her tombstone reads, I am sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Yeah, what a great line for all of us, but especially for her.
Yeah. Let's see. You feature artists who had influence beyond the world of gospel. The Reverend Gary Davis. His work has been recorded by Bob Dylan, Jackson Brown, Peter, Paul, and Mary. Tell us a little bit about the song you included from him, If I Had My Way.
One of the interesting things about Reverend Gary Davis was his kind of ambivalent feelings about religion and secular music. He had this idea of the devil's music, which was the worldly music, and also the church music. And he kind of moved between both worlds. In the 1960s, he was a very influential guitar player who taught lots of people around, but also, as you mentioned, people like Bob Dylan and others just sat at the feet of Gary Davis at his New York City apartment and learned guitar from him, but also learned a lot of his repertoire. And this is a song that certainly goes back to his early days in South Carolina in the 1920s and 1930s.
Let's listen. You also include a medley of songs. We have to mention Lead Belly, because as you write, he's maybe the most popular African-American folk singer of the 20th century.
Yeah, Lead Belly is probably best characterized as the 20th century songster in Black America. And by songster, I'm referring to somebody who has, like Davis, a very wide repertoire. But unlike Davis, he felt comfortable playing in churches and didn't have any ambiguous feelings about going out and playing for what they used to call sookie jumps at the turn of the century in Louisiana. And then when he came up to New York City, he entered a new career, and really for a lot of people, I remember interviewing Pete Seeger for the biography that I co-authored of Lead Belly, and he said, Lead Belly opened up a whole new world for us up here in the North. We had heard about these black musicians and heard their records, but Lead Belly was really the one that brought that music to us directly.
Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home.
Some more recent recordings. You have a 1988 version of Thank You, Lord. This is sung by Alvin Dockett and Blessed. It's a group of high school students. Well, at the time, they were from Washington, D.C., which, you know, it brings the question, is gospel as vibrant, do you think, as it's been at different times?
I think that gospel music in particular is probably the most interesting and varied form of Black American music today, and it is surprisingly, in many ways, very traditional. You find a lot of ties back to performance practices and repertoire that easily go back to the 19th century, and there's really a strong sense of family and community in so much gospel music that it's probably in some ways the most traditional and in other ways the most forward-thinking and the most complex and understudied form of Black American music here in the 21st century.
By Alvin Dockett and Blessed. We've been speaking with Kip Wornell. He put together this Smithsonian Folkways CD, Classic African American Gospel. He also wrote the liner notes. He's a professor of music and ethnomusicology at George Washington University. Kip Wornell, do you have a favorite you want to leave us with?
The bands from the United House of Prayer for All People, the Madison Stones. The church actually began in New England around Providence and is spread in. There are plenty of United House of Prayers for All People, really from North Carolina up into New England and the Boston area. And on Sundays, the way that they praise the Lord with song is to praise Him with brass instruments. This is loud, vibrant, really moving, energetic music. It's one of those things that's kind of a regional unknown, and it's something in a form of music that more people should know something about.
Okay, so here's Madison's Lively Stones, one of the brass bands from the United House of Prayer for All People, their version of It's Time to Make a Change. Kip, thanks.
Okay, thank you.